this particular session is Josie Iacarella, who is a PhD candidate in my lab and a Domlinson doctoral fellow at McGill. Her research examines how the impacts of introduced aquatic predators are mediated by their species traits, and she's collaborating with various colleagues in Europe and South Africa to work on developing a novel risk assessment approach to predict the ecological impacts of non-native predators. Okay. There you go, Josie.
All right. Thank you all for continuing to stay here throughout the day. I feel like both Tony and Hendry's talk this morning are really good lead-ups to what I'll be talking about in this talk. So as we saw from Tony, impacts of invasive species vary very greatly due to the context of the invasion. And I'll be talking specifically about the spatiotemporal context of invasions and how impact varies as invasive species spread. So as Andrew Hendry noted, invasive species can be very different in their invaded range compared to their native range. I'll be talking about how they're different within a spreading range, so within a population. So the impact of invasive species is a measure of their per capita effect multiplied by their abundance in the invaded habitat. And because I'll be talking or primarily focusing about differences between individuals in a spreading population, I'll be focusing primarily on per capita effect, especially in terms of consumption of predatory invaders. So it's generally recognized that impact varies temporally. It's not static over time. And I'll be talking in a bit specifically about how impact varies across spatiotemporal gradients. But just in general right now, you can see that both functional distinctiveness and abundance can change over time, and this has implications for the effect of the invader. So you can imagine that when a new invasive species enters a system, it may take some time for the community to evolve to that invader, particularly if it is a functionally distinct animal. So over time, as the community responds to the invader or as the invader responds to the community, its impact may change. And then also with abundance, generally when invaders are new in a system, they come in at very low abundances, and over time, generally, their abundances will increase, and that can also increase their impact. However, currently we don't have a great representation of this in the literature. So the main problem is indicated here in the top graph. You can see that the majority of studies don't provide the time since invasion of their study organism. And this is probably largely due to just a lack of knowledge. So it's very hard to find when invasive species first enter a system because they do come in at such low numbers. Furthermore, there are very few studies that study impact of invaders within the first 10 years that they have invaded a system. So most of the studies that we have are after 11 years of invasion. So it's very hard to tell what they're doing early on an invasion. And this also could be a lack of interest. So sometimes we don't become interested in studying invasive species until we've already recognized that it has some interesting effect on a community. Another way to study temporal variation and impact would be to just capture this variation in the duration of an experiment. However, in the bottom graph, you can see that most studies only last within the length of a year, and most studies don't go beyond 3 years' time span. So there's definitely a need to identify how long the invaders have been in a system when we're doing these studies, and also just to directly create experiments that study temporal variation and impact. But we do have several hypotheses that are fairly well supported thus far that help us explain why we see spatiotemporal variation and impact. And the first two are based on variation due to community structure. So this is the enemy release hypothesis and the prey naivety hypothesis. And then the second set are based on variation due to the dispersal process, and these are based on personality traits and assortative mating. So I'll be talking about each of these individually. So the enemy release hypothesis states that when an invader is in a system without predators or without enemies, it's much more likely to have a high impact because it can reach higher abundance levels. So you can imagine that in a well-established area here on the left side of the screen, there may be predators that are more well adapted to control the populations of the invader since it's been in that system for a longer period of time. Whereas as we move to an invasion front, if there's no functionally similar animal, there may not be a predatory control in that area. And I have a very extreme example of this. This is not so much temporal variation, but more based on potentially spatial variation. This was a purposeful introduction in Flathead Lake, Montana, where there was a kokanee salmon populations. So the kokanee salmon were feeding on natural zooplankton in this lake, and they were also providing food for the bears and eagles in the system. We wanted to increase the abundances, or they wanted to increase the abundances of kokanee salmon, so they introduced a native boreal mycid from this region into Flathead Lake. So this is Mysis diluviana. And Mysis diluviana is also a great predator of zooplankton. So what ended up happening was that the mycid ended up not overlapping with the kokanee salmon at all due to the hydrology and also the behavior of the mycid being nocturnal. So the kokanee salmon was a completely ineffective predator of the mycid. The mycid ended up eating all of the zooplankton, and the kokanee salmon populations crashed, and the bears and eagles left the system. So this is an extreme example, but shows what can happen when we don't have an effective predator control, even when we think we've identified a proper predator. So the prey naivety hypothesis is fairly a similar idea, in that when we have well-established areas of invaders or a functionally similar animal already present in a system, the prey items are more likely to be evolutionarily adapted to responding to this predation type. Whereas in new systems, if the invader has just been introduced or spread into a system and there's no functionally similar predator, then the prey are less likely to have adaptive responses. So an example of this with zooplankton is with cladocerans. So cladocerans have a very large suite of both behavioral and morphological adaptations to avoiding predation. And one just really simple example is the growth of the helmet on the back of their heads. So in response to predators, they would grow a helmet, and with the lack of a certain predator cue, they may just have the smooth head that makes them easier to be fed upon. So the next source of spatiotemporal variation that I'll be talking about is due to the dispersal process. Within well-established populations, it's recognized that different individuals have different personality traits. And some of these personality traits are really well linked to dispersal. So you end up with certain individuals with certain behaviors leading the invasion front. And these behaviors have been identified as being asocial, aggressive, and bold. So mosquito fish that are more likely to disperse have also been found to be more asocial in terms of their tendency to shoal. Western bluebirds at invasion fronts are more aggressive in terms of attacking nests. And killifish that are also more likely to disperse are also generally more bold in terms of exploring novel habitat. And you can imagine how these three behaviors, being asocial, aggressive, and bold, all really help an invasive species spread into a novel environment at low densities and be successful. So we end up with these particular personality types leading the invasion front, and this leads to assortative mating between these personality types. So we end up with offspring that are quite different than individuals at the well-established areas. And this has been particularly well studied looking at cane toad invasions in Australia. So this study matched up well-established toads to invasion front toads and raced them. And the well-established toads gave up far earlier than the invasion front toads. So the invasion front toads just kept running. And they weren't actually faster than the well-established toads, but they were more persistent, so they had greater endurance. And they weren't able to identify whether this was a behavioral or a physiological difference, but they did find that it was heritable. So now at the invasion front, we have these individuals that may be both behaviorally and physiologically different than individuals at the well-established site. So the question is, how does this influence per capita effects? Then when we combine this with the potential lack of predator control and potential prey naivety at invasion fronts, you can imagine that at invasion fronts, we may see higher impacts of invasive species. So I'm going to be talking specifically about differences in per capita effects across spatiotemporal gradients, and then get into a bit about the actual impacts on biodiversity that we see in the field. So this is looking at a study I ran looking at two spatiotemporal gradients of Hemimysis animala. This is a Pono-Caspian bloody red shrimp. And I compared these gradients in Ireland and in Quebec, looking at predation rates on natural zooplankton communities. So in the Ireland graph, at the highest zooplankton density, I found in the black bar that the invasion front mysids had a higher predation rate or higher per capita effect than the well-established mysids. In Quebec, I found across the board invasion front mysids had a higher per capita effect than well-established mysids. And this has been supported with other animals as well. So these studies didn't measure per capita effects directly, but they found attributes that can be linked to per capita effects. So African jewelfish and invasion fronts were found to have higher gut fullness, cane toads were found to have faster growth rates, and round gobies were found to have larger body sizes, all at invasion fronts. And again, these may indicate higher predation rates or higher impacts at invasion fronts. So what does this mean for biodiversity in the field? So this is going back to the hemimysis example, looking at sites in Ireland. In the squares, we have an uninvaded site. The circles represent an invasion front, and the triangles represent a well-established site. And we're looking at the diversity of zooplankton at these sites. And you can see that the uninvaded site has the highest diversity, followed by the invasion front site with the lowest diversity at the well-established sites. We're seeing overall accumulating larger impacts at the well-established site. Then bringing it back home to the St. Lawrence River, this is looking at impacts by the round goby, also a Pano-Caspian invader. And this is looking at macroinvertebrate Shannon diversity. And you can see at the top here we have the invasion front at 0 years, and then moving down we're getting into more well-established areas. At the bottom we have 4 to 7 years of round goby invasion. And it's very clear that diversity is declining with the longer time the invader has been in the area. Another round goby example from Sturgeon Bay is looking at mussel abundance. So in the orange line, we have the abundance of round gobies. And at 30 kilometers, we have the invasion front of the goby. So you can see that in these sites that are close to the invasion front, we get more mussel abundance. And then at the more well-established sites, there's much lower abundances of mussels. So again, higher impacts at these well-established sites. Okay, so I showed you indication that there's likely higher per capita effects at invasion fronts, but also generally lower impacts on biodiversity at invasion fronts. So there may be some different things going on here, and I'm not quite sure what the answer is yet. One of these contributing factors may just be a lag time in community response. So maybe that invasion front individuals are having a very high immediate impact, but we're not seeing the full community response at the time that we're measuring. Also, clearly, it's difficult to measure when we're comparing impacts of, across 1 year to impacts that have been occurring for 7 years. So that may also be a factor. But another thing that may be going on is that there's differences in abundance level. And as I showed you at the very beginning, abundance is also a contributing factor of impact. So at invasion fronts, clearly we have, as you can see here, lower abundances. And this may be a trade-off with per capita effects. So invasion fronts, we have high per capita effect, low abundance, and the complete opposite at well-established sites. And so it's not quite clear yet how these two interact with each other or trade off. But generally speaking, management is a lot more effective in terms of controlling the spread of invasive species rather than trying to mitigate the invader once they're well-established. So thus far, these higher per capita effects indicate that, again, it's more beneficial to try to prevent the spread of invaders rather than focusing on mitigating well-established invaders. But this trade-off between per capita effect and abundance remains an interesting question to me. So I'd like to thank MSC and QCBS, as well as Tony and Andy, for the opportunity to speak here today, and thank you all for listening.
Are there any questions?
Right. You could also have evolution of things that they're interacting with on the invasion front, which could change the difference between invasion front effects and effects back behind.
You mean over time at the invasion front?
Yeah, I mean it's not just the round gobies that are evolving, but the things with which they're interacting. Mm-hmm. And so that could change effects between invasion front and further back, invasion back, because it's not the gobies themselves that are having the dramatically different per capita effects, but the local organisms are responding differently to them through evolution or plasticity or something.
Yeah, so it's likely that that the if there's no functionally similar animal already there, then it seems likely that the invader will instantly have a higher impact, but then over time the community will become more adapted to it, and it's likely that the impact will decline over time.
Right, I mean just the individuals in the community, like they're feeding on zebra mussels or something like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the zebra mussels, well, presumably removing the less resistant zebra mussels on the invasion front,
mm-hmm.
which would change the per capita effects of the invader, but not because the invader is different, but because the recipient communities.
There, so they're affecting a different part of the community, yeah.
Okay, thank you very much. Now, what we're